Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and or good evening. In case you don't know where you are, this is the Silmarillion Film Project. So if you're here on purpose, that's great. If you're here by accident, that's okay too. This is Trish Lambert introducing for Dave Kahle, who we are happy to say is now a father the second time. Halloween baby, Matilda Jane Kahle.
Matilda Jane Kahle. Yes, he's absent for the best of reasons. The successful birth of his healthy second child. So mom and baby and big brother and I think dad are all apparently doing well. So
apparently fine. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very exciting news. So we will hope to be rejoined by him. Maybe not until the first December episode, but they're still coping with the whole multiple child household thing right now, which I totally get. This is the most exciting reason to not have Dave with us here tonight.
That's right. But we do have Corey Olson, the Tolkien professor, and me, Trish Lambert, and our script writing team.
That's right. That's right. Yes, we have Rhiannon, Marie, and Nick with us tonight. So, awesome.
Hello. Howdy.
Yeah, welcome.
Hello.
Welcome, everybody. Good. So before we get jumping back into our script discussions, I was really excited about today's scripts. I was moved at several points. There were various feelings that were moved within me at various points, but I was definitely moved at certain places. But anyway, just before we get in too far, just some quick announcements. The biggest announcement is just Baymoot. So Baymoot is coming up out in Berkeley, California. We're going to have our moot out there on Saturday, November 23rd, and the registration is up. So if you go to the Baymoot page, you can find that. Actually, let me show you. Where is it? This. Here it is. So here's the Signum homepage. I say show it. I should probably actually do that for those who are in GoToWebinar. How about that? Okay, there we go. I know the folks on Twitch can see it. So just a few things here. If you go to signumuniversity.org and scroll down, you see all the exciting current things. We're coming to the end. Tomorrow is the last day to take advantage of our special on folkloric transformations, course by Dimitra Femi, on things like vampires and stuff and their transformation from traditional folklore through to modern films and things. It's a really, really fascinating course. So we're doing our special, which ends tomorrow. So if you want to get in on that, you should get in on that right away. We've got, of course, our spring courses, including our brand new course on classical myths and legends. We've done a lot with Germanic stuff, of course, Germanic myths and our Old Norse stuff that our sagas class and everything. And so in this class, we're going into the Greco-Roman tradition. And looking at some of those original writings. So that class is all the works will be taught in translation in that class. So I have the opportunity to audit this one live and participate in the lectures as they go on and everything. So a really fun semester there. And then upcoming events, we've got, this is where, of course, you can click on through to our Baymoot page and find the registration button. There's also, this is a special session that's happening just this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, a discussion on Narnia and friendship. This is a part of an ongoing course, one of our fall courses. No, it's not fall. Right. Yes, it is fall. Okay, it is fall right now. I forget what season I'm in. In one of our ongoing fall courses by Bretton Dickinson. The Mythology of Love and Sex, looking at C.S. Lewis and his take on love and sort of C.S. Lewis's The Four Loves is kind of at the heart of that course, and looking at a bunch of Lewis's fiction And so this is going to be a discussion on friendship and Narnia, and this is going to be with Brenton Dickinson and with Diana Glier, who is, of course, the author of The Company They Keep and of Bandersnatch, wonderful C.S. Lewis scholar who's going to be joining Brenton. And so this is just going to be basically a publicly open class session for that discussion. So everyone is encouraged to join there. And again, you can get to the registration link through this page here on our homepage. So anyway, those are some of the things that are coming up soon. One film thing that I wanted to mention is, of course, as we're getting towards, we're in now our post-production period. I want to draw people's attention to the casting call. We have a few suggestions, but would love more suggestions. We've got a couple pretty big names that need to be cast, including, of course, Gandalf and Glorfindel, who both need to be cast here. So nominations and suggestions for actors who could play those roles, not only those two, of course, but all the other new characters that we're casting this time. Would be really great. So I encourage you to go to the discussion boards. And Marie, can you tell us where people can find that when they go in?
Sure. So there's a casting form, and the subforms for that are by season. So they would go to the season 4 nominations subform.
So casting season 4 nominations. Okay, great.
Yep.
Excellent. Very good. Okay. So, this is these are the instructions for how you can find the scripts to look over them yourself. I highly recommend them; they are excellent reading. Again, go to the Film Project, click on Script, and then Season 4, and then Scripts and Script Outlines for Season 4, in order to be able to find these. So we're gonna start with Episode 6. We talked a little bit about Episode 6 at the end of our last session, but we want to go through it a little bit more systematically. So I'll just read the initial synopsis, and then I'll let you guys, the writing team, kind of talk our way through it act by act, and I'll kind of give some input and bring up some things that I was really struck by as we go through. So In this episode, Sauron and Thorin Gwethil try to ferret out the secret of the Kinslaying to drive a wedge between the Sindar and the Noldor. Círdan learns who burnt the ships at Lothgar, and Aethelos and Angrod experience captivity in Angband. So we have our first major capture by Sauron and his team. Okay, so Act One. Tell me some things about Act One of this episode. Things that were going on. Things that you guys were wanting to emphasize. Challenges that you guys were sort of confronting in those scenes.
So
this is the first episode after the Marath Arathoth.
After the Marath.
So we're trying to So we're trying to follow up on that, and that was obviously mostly a party atmosphere and fairly positive with some dark undertones. Mm-hmm. So this one starts out on a lighter note and then focuses more on that darkness.
Right, right.
And so this being that kind of continuation, we got to see Thorin Gwethil in like full-on secret agent mode.
Yes.
Right? So we saw her doing kind of like silent and invisible surveillance. Mm-hmm. We saw her at the party with Sauron doing some sort of espionage / sabotage. In this one, she's really all on her own. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was really a challenge was to find a way to get the audience worried for her safety. You know, like, right. Anytime that I can get the audience like on the villain's side, even a little bit, is always a win.
Right. Right. Yeah. There were some kind of tense moments, you know, when with Thorin Gwethil on the ship. That was interesting.
On the other hand, go on.
So one thing I'd like to bring up, just because I thought this was really funny, is we spent a while in our script discussion talking about what should Sauron and Thirngwethel's disguise names be, and I was very much in favor of them just switching their names and having them their names backwards. So Thirngwethel would be like Lithwigugzabuth,
right?
And Sauron would be Norrous,
right?
But I was upvoted, so I had to come up with a different name for Thirngwethel, and Sauron didn't actually end up using a disguise name. But right. Thirngwethel I chose to call Will-Willeth, because it sort of has that same sound as Thirngwethel, so it's not quite Thirngwethel backwards, but it has that TH and that G sound in it.
Yes.
And it also means butterfly in Sindarin. Nice. So it's a vampire calling herself Butterfly.
Right. Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. And yeah, I mean, of course, having them disguise themselves by giving their names backwards would have been an awesome Easter egg, right, for like fans of the Lay of Lathian. But yeah, I think that would probably be a relatively small percentage even of our audience who would get the reference there to Beren and Finrod. Felagund disguising their names that way.
Right. And while you can kind of sell the idea that an elvish name backwards is an orcish name, it's a little harder to sell the idea yes. that those names backwards are elvish. Yeah. Nauros actually isn't that bad. But
not really.
But Thorngwethel would have been
not nearly elvish at all. Yeah, I agree.
One of the other things, so one of the difficulties in constructing a surprise in a television episode is you have to make the surprise kind of work on a second watching. Mm-hmm. Like, not that the audience is surprised anymore. Like, they know what's coming.
Yeah.
But we want them to be sitting there going, oh.
Yeah.
You know, you want them, and you want the surprise to be possible.
Yeah.
So it was very important for Angrod and Edelas, for example, who are they're captured. Well, they appear to be captured by Tavildo's cats on their way home from their son's wedding. It was very important that they be separated,
right,
for a time,
right,
right, to give plausibility to the idea that Angrod may not be who he seems. However, the first time that you watch it, it doesn't even occur to you.
No, and that went absolutely past me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was not even suspicious.
Right, and I think the idea that the fact that Thirngwethel is off doing her secret agent routine actually works as kind of like a double blind in a way.
Yes, yes.
Because it draws attention away from this kind of sneaky, underhanded thing. And when you see Edelas and Angrod, you're seeing them actually building their relationship, which makes it even creepier.
Yes.
You know, that's it when, so on that second watching, people who have seen it before are watching going,
it's so painful. Yeah, it's so painful. Yeah, I actually, you know, because I had read episode 6 for last time, which we didn't quite finished discussing, so I read it again before this session, and yeah, like reading through it the second time, oh man, those scenes in the cell, like those post-torture scenes, were so painful. That was so painful, you know, knowing the truth the second time. So yeah, I mean, I definitely felt that it worked that way. It obviously, as you say, it can't have the same effect a second time, but it still had a powerful, it wasn't just like, oh, now I see through the trick, you know, like when you know where the rabbit's coming from, you know, when it's pulled out of the hat, the trick isn't interesting anymore, right? It can't just be like that, and it definitely wasn't. It definitely wasn't.
Yeah, and to back to Thirngwethel for a moment, another challenge there was to not let Círdan catch on too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we had to kind of give her excuses to kind of. Because obviously she has to appear as though she does not want to give up this information.
Right, right.
The original plan had been for her to be Sindarin and to pretend to have come across this information.
Right.
But in if she's Noldor, it A, makes it more believable, mm-hmm. right? Like, she doesn't mm-hmm. have to come up with a story for how she knows this.
Right, right, right.
But also, now she has to be reticent to give up this information, or appear to be reticent to give up the information.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, in that, I mean, unless there are other things you guys want to say about Act 1, that kind of transitions into Act 2, that when Thuringwethel's character reveals the death of her husband on the Helcaraxa, that I thought was, I mean, again, especially contrasted with the fake Sindarin conspirator angle, right? That I thought was a really interesting, you know, if the first thing she confesses is her grief, right, and anger about the death of her husband, and so that would justify her kind of ranting about the Sons of Feanor, right, which is where she goes originally, you know, initially there, and I think that that's I think that that's a really interesting angle, not least, of course, because it serves as a foil to Galadriel and Celeborn, right? I mean, she's not, it's not the same as Galadriel's issues, right? But it's kind of similar, like, you know, Noldor woman grieving over losses on the, you know, trauma and losses experienced on the way, and, you know, finally opens up to, you know, a trustworthy Sindar gentleman, right, who is there and sympathetically listening, right? It's kind of an interesting parallel, well, sort of anti-parallel, right, in some ways. But that, I thought, was really kind of a fun touch.
Well, the closest parallel I was really trying to make with Thuringwethel is actually her being parallel to Turgon. And I even have absolutely. Her at yeah. one point saying, "Do not ask this of me, because for me the grief is still too near," which is like the exact same line
yes.
that yes. Turgon delivered to Círdan in episode 4 while Thuringwethel was secretly spying on them.
Right, right.
So she's using that to her advantage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's great. And that parallel was also clear. So yeah, it's I thought that that all came together in really interesting ways. Her eagerness to share is again, it's I know that's a really difficult line to walk, right? You know, how she has to look real, as you know, Nick, as you were saying, she has to look really reluctant, and you know, while of course being entirely eager to, you know, her whole objective is to say these things. So that's it's a tricky thing to do to make that really believable.
Meanwhile, on the completely other side of Beleriand, we have a subplot of the Noldor finally meeting the dwarves. And one of the reasons we did a little bit of moving around here. We kind of did a little bit of a shell game with the dwarves here, by introducing them at, Carinthir's fortress, the name of which is escaping me at the moment, by introducing
Celeborn is the lake, so we just called it Celeborn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. By introducing them there in this episode, it allows us to tell the story of the deal that they make in the next episode without having to to lay too much groundwork. Mm-hmm. It also allowed us to bring the Aeol story in.
Yes.
Ahead of time, foreshadowing next season.
Yeah, I was a little surprised at that. I wasn't expecting that. When that came out. I mean, I kind of liked it, especially mm-hmm. since it seemed to be kind of an interesting ice-breaking thing, right? That, like, the fact that Carinthir and Telkar end up kind of having this, like, yeah, some of them Sindar just ain't right, you know, kind of bonding yeah. moment, right?
Yeah.
Which was interesting.
Takes away the entirely wrong message. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. But yeah. No. I liked how that worked. I mean, I could see that there's a kind of risk being taken there in not in spoiling. I don't mean spoiling, but in kind of doing the Aeol story indirectly here, so that when we come back to Aeol himself next season, primarily, you know, we'll already have the, but I mean, I think we can follow that up in some interesting ways.
We can hear Aeol's version of his story, which probably won't be the same as Telkar's.
Won't be the same. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And we can tell different details about the story.
Yeah.
You know, there are definitely details that we're leaving out of the story here that are going to come out later on. But at the same time, we can kind of gloss over some of the basics next season, that it's basically just kind of conserving our time a little bit. Mm-hmm. And also, we've kind of developed the situation where the way that dwarves deal with uncomfortable topics with the elves is they tell a story about this time that was kind of like this. And I'm not entirely certain where, like, if that has any basis in anything else.
Right.
But it's a really interesting development that has come out over this season.
Yeah, I like that. I mean,
both Norn and Telkar are taking this approach.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's cool. I mean, any way that a particular kind of idiosyncrasy or kind of wrinkle of dwarf culture sort of emerges, you know, during the writing process, I think that's kind of fun. I don't see any reason why that kind of thing should be resisted. I think that's great. I really liked the meeting between Caranthir and Telkar. I was, at first I was a little bit, I don't know. Trepidatious is a little too strong a word, but I was like, like, what's going to happen here? Like, you know, I was having a hard time seeing when the first scene came. I'm like, where are we going exactly? And how is this going to be linking in? I mean, I knew that we kind of needed to do it, and it was kind of an extra thing in some, you know, not hugely directly connected with all the rest of the plot and stuff. But I loved the way that it came out. I mean, I thought that was, that whole sequence between this episode and the next episode with Caranthir was like by far the like coolest character development of Caranthir we've done, which was cool. I mean, like, hey, he's not just a brainless thug. I mean, he's still is kind of a brainless thug, but you know, to see him acting. I mean, him and Telkar laughing together.
Kind of hold his hand a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Corfin has to help him in the brains department, but still, like, you know, the whole
Caranthir is probably not a terrible carouser.
Yeah, no, like, I think not.
Like, you could probably take him out on the town and probably have a good time.
Yeah, yeah. No, when Caranthir and Telkar are laughing together, I loved. I just loved that.
Yeah, we had agreed at the beginning of the project that Caranthir would have the least character development of any of the Sons of Feanor. He kind of starts out as a jerk. He kind of ends as a jerk. He doesn't become more or less of a jerk throughout. He just is kind of consistently himself
from his
introduction until his death. So knowing that, it would be easy to make him a caricature where it's like, we need someone to be angry and stupid. Hey, Caranthir, you need to be in the scene. So this was an opportunity to have him be on screen and not being angry and stupid. He's still himself. He's not particularly good at the diplomacy thing.
No, but he's not. I mean, he calls them stunted people in like his first sentence.
Like I said, not too good at diplomacy.
Yeah. But I mean, I really kind of like the fact that Telkar like gave as good as she got as far as that was concerned, you know? It was really kind of nice, and shows also it was a good way to stress the sort of alien perspective of the dwarves, like how the dwarves, you know, have become allies with the Sindar, but it's not like they're like totally biased on the side of the Sindar or anything, you know, they're kind of official, even though they've had good relations with the Sindar, they're kind of outside the whole elf thing, right? And you definitely feel that with them. And also the way, especially when the rest of them come in, I mean, the other sons, you know, the others are the Sons of Feanor, to the conversation in the next episode, the way that they clearly, the kind of connection between the dwarves and the Noldor, right? What they have in common and what they can sort of both appreciate was, you know, starting to come through as well, I think. So it was, in the end, I definitely felt that that exchange, that this whole moment there with Carinthir and Telkar was effective in building, especially in not only character development and kind of seeing the Feanorian's world to some extent, but also, you know, more further development of the dwarves. I thought that was cool.
Yeah. Another thing that I thought was really interesting is it's got to be a really interesting feeling for the dwarves to meet the Noldor after having met the Sindar. Mm-hmm. So when they make first contact with the Sindar appear to them to be like unwashed savages, right. Essentially. Like right. They don't make anything out of metal. They don't have any permanent homes. Residences yeah, that they can really
yeah.
see.
Yeah.
Then they meet the Noldor, and the Noldor are a very, very different
yes.
animal in a way. Yeah. You know, the first contact is with Carinthir, and like at first, in this first meeting that's in this episode, sure, they might think that the Noldor are kind of the same as the Sindar, but then Carinthir brings them to his place, and there's this stone building with like defensible, you know, yeah. ramparts and stuff like that, and they're like, oh, these guys are different.
Yeah, we've got stuff we can talk about with these guys.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. This is worthwhile.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's cool. I really like that. So Act Two was the like particularly heartbreaking moment when Angrod is trying to keep up Aethelos' spirit. Again, heartbreaking in retrospect.
Yes.
Second time through.
And he tells her the sun still shines, or the sun doth still shine.
The sun doth yeah. still shine. Yeah. The fact that that came from him originally. Oh, man. Oh, yeah. man.
Yeah.
I mean, I just... So, I tend, if anything, to kind of dislike surprise for the sake of surprise. You know, yeah. the, like... You know, sudden turn and reveal, like, oh, the person you thought was a good guy is actually a bad guy all along, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
I often am just annoyed by that kind of thing, but I yeah. felt it was really, really effective the way that you guys yeah. did this because yeah. of the way that it said, when you see and when you, the way that the reveal causes you to reconsider everything through the episode before that, right? The way that you can yeah. see the really remarkably cunning and powerful way in which Sauron had been setting her up and undermining her hope and strength all the way through.
Right. Yes.
Is
yes.
so cool.
A little bit at a time. Right.
Yeah.
And also we had to be a little careful. And this is one of the things like subtlety is so important, especially when you're dealing with a character like Sauron, mm-hmm. it can't be too heavy handed.
Right.
Like he can't be too sappy.
Yes. Yes.
You know, because if he's too sappy, then the audience might start to get suspicious. Like, okay, like what's up here?
Yeah.
You know, right. what's coming? It's one of those things where, you know, like there's like three levels of surprise. There's the level of surprise which becomes not a surprise at all because you kind of like start to suspect that something's up, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you saw, for example, Spider-Man Far From Home and you said, wait, this Mysterio guy, anyway, then there's another layer of surprise where you, when you look back, you think to yourself, oh, like that was obviously him. I should have guessed that.
Right. Right.
You know, where you're kind of like kicking yourself for yes. Or yes. like, there were clues, but they weren't solid enough,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the surprise that just completely floors you and you're like, wait, what? You know, you can't even wrap your head around it at first because it's so shocking. And I feel like we were kind of going for somewhere between two and three here.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted it to come as a complete surprise, but at the same time, we wanted to make it so that a person watching it the second time will kind of see
what he's doing,
where
yeah.
like yeah. like see what he's right yeah. right you're yeah. watching him do it
yeah
the
yeah.
second time around
yeah Yeah. Yeah. No, I thought that was really, really well handled. I was a huge fan of this episode. I still am a huge fan of this episode.
This was one of my favorites.
Yeah. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And the way, again, you know, you're absolutely right that the way that the Thorin Gwethil plot serves as like a distraction, you know, that you're, you know, because you think you've got a handle on, like, you've got the subterfuge happening over here, and then you've got the suffering prisoners over here, and, you know, you don't even, it really emphasizes that. Okay, so one of the things that I was thinking about Act 3, back to the Círdan and Thorin Gwethil plot for a second, Círdan's reactions, right? So his kind of acceptance of the Oath of Feanor, like, yeah, okay, that's probably not a good idea. But, like, you know, it's understandable. I mean, it was kind of amusing, right? The moments where she's like, and then they swore this terrible oath. Oh, you know, I have to admit that. And he's like, yeah, well, you know, no big deal. Like, and it's like, yeah. But at least their cause was just. And then she's like, well, no, actually, it really wasn't totally just.
Well, also, he wasn't there.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, he doesn't know what it, like, if he had been there, he, like, all the red flags were there, right?
Right, right.
But just knowing that they swore an oath, it's like, okay, that's not great.
Yeah.
It's not the end of the world. Like, right. if that's your big news, I mean,
it's underwhelming.
Like, I'm
sorry
that you're upset about your husband, but
right. Yeah. Yeah.
People can't look at oaths as bad all the time, because, like, Finrod will swear an oath knowing that oaths are kind of bad, but not thinking it's the worst possible thing he could do.
No, yeah. I mean, oaths are not evil intrinsically, necessarily. I mean, it's like, it can put you in an awkward position, but it's not like, yeah, I mean, Finrod isn't doing wrong when he swears his oath to Barahir. He does, again, paint himself into a corner later on, but,
yeah,
you know, but at the same time, I'm not even sure. I mean, his oath binds. I mean, you think of Finrod's oath in particular. Had he not sworn the oath to Barahir, like, what would he have done? Just been like, sorry, Baron, buzz off. Like, I don't care. Right. I mean, there still would have been some kind of a like, there's a certain kind of moral imperative to help Baron. Right. I mean, even if he hadn't sworn the oath. So again, it's not like it's impelling him to do something horrible or anything.
Right.
So yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Oaths themselves don't have to be evil. The terms of the Oath of Feanor are really sketchy.
I think that the delivery of his lines will make a huge difference in whether or not it comes off like he's being naive, or whether he's like, okay,
right,
you know,
I'm
like
being
that.
Wise and patient and trying to be understanding. Yeah,
right, right. Yeah. You know, because, like, it looks kind of like she's got this axe to grind up against the Feanorians, and so she's describing it as a terrible oath. What does that actually mean, though?
Right, right.
Because she's not, like, she didn't recite it to him.
Right. You
know, she doesn't know it.
She
wasn't
know it.
There.
Exactly, right. She can't recite it.
He wasn't there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
She tells Círdan that she saw Feanor wearing the Silmarils around right before Morgoth stole them. She wasn't there. She's just making that up.
Totally making that up.
Right.
Which,
right. Now she knows it happened because Morgoth was there.
Right, right, exactly. But I loved that moment, like that moment when, because the audience knows that's not the case. Like, you know, careful viewers will remember that Feanor had ceased displaying the Silmarils a while before this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But of course, Círdan doesn't know. So that was actually a sort of a fun moment of dramatic irony.
Now, the scene where he kind of, like, he locks her down, right?
Yes.
We had to be a little careful with a number of aspects of this episode, because, like, plot elements from romantic comedies kept, like, popping into. It was a very weird situation because, like, things kept happening that were very romantic comedy when looked at from a certain lens.
Right.
And I was like, okay, well, like, we can't have him, like, ask her down to like his quarters, because that's weird. You know, like that. So having her, like, brought in and he's like seated at a table makes it less that. Right?
Yeah, there was the definite. I mean, even from your sort of stage directions, there was clearly like an adversarial relationship there, rather than a like, "Hey, honey, come down to my private table this evening."
So, but once she's in that room, a few things happen. Because she can't get out without revealing herself.
Yes.
And if she reveals herself, it's over. Like, her mission has failed, because they're not going to believe anything she has to say. Right? So while she probably could escape if she turned into, if she revealed herself as a vampire and flew off, and she is the arch vampire, so we don't really know what her power, personal power level is. We've shown that the elves have been able to take out vampires before,
right?
But we haven't established what her relative power level to them is. Presumably, if he's got like 8 Caliquendi on board and like he raises the alarm, she's probably toast.
Yes.
Unless she gets at the window before
So this was actually something I was a little bit unclear on. Does she flee the ship?
Yes.
We see her like looking at the window, but
When Kierden comes back and the room is empty and the window's open.
Okay. I missed that part of
Right.
I must have read past that in the montage.
Right.
So here's my question. This is the only element of this plot line that I had trouble with, because here's the question which seemed to me unanswered. How does Kierden interpret this? First of all, like, how could she fit through that window? And even if she could fit through that window, is Kierden speculating that she drowned herself?
We were talking about this and at length about a lot of these similar issues.
Yeah.
One thing that's important is the window's got to be big enough that a human being could fit through it. That's got to be the case.
Or else it would totally give away that she's a shapeshifter or something. Right, I mean, he would know some sorcery was afoot if he.
Another thing is he doesn't really know exactly what the Caliquendi are capable of. He knows that they've fared much better against the orcs than the Sindar did.
Yes.
You know, like, they know that. That the initial confrontations with the orcs, the Noldor had almost no casualties whatsoever. Whereas the Sindar had a much tougher fight of it. Right. You know, in the battle under the stars. The first battle under the stars. So
he also knows that the Noldor can swim because they swim at the Marathatathad.
Right.
So she could have, Kierden might have interpreted as she jumped out the window and swam away.
It's also okay. they're like right near Eglarest at this point.
So they're like in sight of land when this happens.
Gone and gone away.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a reason that she can't then like disembark like normal?
The reason is because then she'll be in the city and there'll be more eyes on her. It'll be tougher for her to pull that off.
But if she's got to just vanish sooner or later, wouldn't it be easy to vanish? I mean, like, yeah, he'd look around for her and be like, "Hey, where'd she go?" Like, but I mean, that's less dramatic than like, she was locked in this room and now she's gone. She must have swum across the ocean. Like, that's way more suspicious than, I mean,
that's fair.
Than just where did she come? You know, where did she go? My fear is the weird.
She went for the dramatic.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. She went for the dramatic exit because she needed to get back to Angband quickly and her task was done. So she didn't really care what Kierden thought afterwards.
Right.
But it was in the middle of the eclipse, so it seems like a prime moment for her to fly off to.
Yeah. She and Sauron might have arranged this as a signal or something. This might have been her time to go back.
It's just my fear is the weirder her departure looks to Kierden, it's explicitly said, I think in the beginning of episode 7, right?
Mm-hmm.
that he could tell that there is malice behind these rumors, but he assumed that it was the, I mean, I, you know, that's adapted straight from the line from the text, right? About right. assuming that the malice was the malice of the sons of Feanor. But you know, again, like within that circumstance, I'm like, Círdan didn't even ask himself the question, like, gosh, could there have been some kind of, like, might this have been an agent of the enemy? I mean, like, with the sudden, strange, very unusual disappearance, it kind of seemed to me like that's got to at least cross his mind as an option, right? Whereas, again, well, if she just vanishes in the city, it's fine. Now, I like the timing of the eclipse, and I don't think we need to add, like, a landing scene and saying farewell on the quay and all that kind of thing.
I can tell you it does reduce the tension a little bit, for like it's not as tense. Her departure is not as critical if we put her on land to do it. What if we were a bit more explicit, like they're within swimming distance of the dock, like they're not far enough away for it to be unreasonable for a decently healthy and fit person to make it there.
But even if go ahead, Rihanna.
Well, you know what else we could do is one of the things I was trying to sort of bring up, I didn't make it super clear, was that Círdan was going to like keep her with him and guarded from the other Noldor because she didn't want the other.
Yeah.
The Noldor to find out. That was sort of her cover story. She's like, oh no, they will see it in my eyes that I have revealed the secret. So Círdan, like, she's asked Círdan to protect her from them. And so Círdan is like, yes, I'll protect you from them by like keeping you locked up and away from them. So he could be saying something about maybe there's like a room on the ship that doesn't have any windows that she could escape from. So she's like, this is my chance to escape now. I may not have another chance. Yeah. I need to move.
Right.
Yeah, she doesn't know exactly what her circumstances are going to be in the future. So I mean, we knew at the time that we were playing it that there we'd have to be very very careful about this in order to pull it off.
Is there a way in which the circumstances could be manipulated just a little bit so that it looks at least a plausible interpretation? That one of the other Noldor offed her.
Or maybe helped her escape.
Like something. Yeah. Like basically if he can come away from, if there's a good reason for Círdan to respond to her sudden disappearance with added suspicion against the Noldor, right? Either look, they're conspiring together, or like, oh, so she spilled the beans and gave away the truth, and they what? They killed her? Like they like shoved her out the window and drowned her? You know,
he hasn't arrived at Kinslaying yet,
right?
So he probably wouldn't think that they killed her, but definitely that they helped her escape or something.
But he could, in retrospect, he could be puzzled by it, and then when he and Thingol arrive at the Kinslaying thing, he could be, you know, he could say something like, well, you know, perhaps this sheds light on what happened to, you know, the poor Noldor vanished from the, you know, like maybe she could, you know, one of the Fëanorians caught up with her and she swims with the fishes now, you know, like it's.
How would we indicate, like other than like blood on the floor, I'm not sure how we.
Because like framing her own death would be kind of a cool departure technique for Thorin Greyjoy.
Yeah. Well, she could like her garment or something, because if bats don't wear dresses, she could leave the dress that she was wearing.
Yeah, or at least even just to like tear it or something, so it looks like there was she was, you know, shoved out the window by an act of violence or something. I don't know. I mean,
She were to, well, first thing, she'd have to bleed for this to work. But if she were to cut herself with a knife and leave the knife, it definitely lends plausibility that like something went down there.
She got stabbed and her corpse thrust out the window. Yeah.
Or she was trying to defend herself. Yeah. Like, you know.
So if basically, so this could be accomplished then with no other change to the plot apart from what Círdan finds when he gets back in. So imagine he, in the montage thing, right, we show him returning to his cabin, right? So if if on his way back to his cabin, all he has to do is like a couple of the Noldor who are on board have to be walking away from the cabin in the other direction when he's walking towards it. Right. Mm-hmm. Which can be totally innocent. But like, you know, so he sees a bunch of the Noldor. And especially if we set this up in that scene that you guys had earlier on where Thorngwethel's all like, oh, like, I'm afraid of the other Noldor, like, protect me from them. Right. If we can show her like looking out at like these Noldor who are standing, you know, not too far away. And then he sees
the same ones.
Yes. He sees those same ones moving away from the door. And then he comes in and he sees, you know, signs of you know, signs of violence
of a struggle.
And you know, and the, you know, so for her to fake her own death would seem a cooler exit strategy because it would like fit it better with her story.
And, like she, we can actually, at, when he leaves, we can see her pick up the knife so that we, like, we know what she did.
Yeah.
Like, so it's not too, like, because otherwise it's like you have the audience trying to piece together what just happened and it's too quick to really do that. We don't want to be spending enough time for the audience to kind of
Exactly. No, I think that could be done really without adding any time at all. Just a couple other, just a couple other scene, you know, a couple other things that we'd have to see during that. And it's kind of a more devious strategy on her part too, because now instead of being, you know, him being like, okay, so I was told this by this Noldor lady who seemed kind of nice, but then she like totally vanished and it was a little bit weird and I'm not sure. Now instead he would be like, oh, like the poor martyred Noldor who, you know, the, it's going to make what she told him much, much more, believable. And of course his suspicion against the Noldor would be, much more sharp, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. I like that. I think that's a, I think that's an efficient solution, to that issue. But yeah, that was the only like scene that I wanted to develop a little bit more. I just, I can't think of any improvements on the Sauron Angrod thing. I mean, that was fantastic.
Yeah. Like his leg's clearly broken and then he just the gets up, walks away.
No, it was just awesome from beginning to end. That was really fantastic. And the eclipse, I got chills with like the whole the sun doth still shine thing, and then the eclipse comes at the end. I was like, oh man, it's horrible.
Welcome to the Silmarillion, everybody.
That was just so like the gut punch of the end of that episode was just incredible.
Well, I feel like this is the first time in a long time that the villains have the upper hand. Like they really are on their back foot from
the arrival of Feanor, right?
Yeah. Well, not even before that, like it, through most of season three, they're on their back foot. They get a little bit of traction in South of Beleriand. Once
Sauron
start getting involved, but they really like they're playing defense through most of that. And this is the first time that we see them really, really get a victory out of their conflict with the elves.
No, and I mean, just this is, even thinking about this from another angle, this is one of my favorite moments of Sauron character development that we've gotten yet. I mean,
this is Sauron,
you know, this is, you know,
this is what he's going to do to Gorlim later.
Yes.
But yeah,
absolutely.
Almost worse in a way. Cause like he just, Gorlim just saw his wife from a distance. Like he was right there with her. And when he leaves her, like she doesn't know that it's not Angrod. She doesn't know it's not her husband.
Because he doesn't change until after he's out of the cell.
I love that. I loved that. Yes. Yes. He gets up and closes the door. And then we, the audience, see him be, change back into Myron in the hall. But yeah. Yeah. No, that was,
If this were Game of Thrones, that would be the final scene of the episode. But yeah, this is not Game of Thrones.
This is not Game of Thrones. And I love the final scene of the episode is Morgoth and the Eclipse and being worshipped out in Hildorian. Fantastic. I loved that. I mean, that was such a powerful last moment there.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a little tough because we're playing a little fast and loose with time there. But I feel like it's okay, especially if you're doing kind of a mid credits teaser thing.
Right.
It's not that big a deal.
Right. Yep. Yep. Agreed.
Anything else on 6 before we?
No, let's go ahead and go to 7 because we're moving slowish, but that's okay.
Yes.
Okay. So the King's Ire, by the way, a little sub note here. I love the great work on the, I think it's really consistently good work on the episode titles. I loved the way that the Sun Doth Still Shine was, you know, really top shelf, but, the way that this connected, tied the frame and the main episode together. And, even with the Aeol plot and stuff, I mean, it was, and Aron Ruth, right? I mean, it was cool. I really liked this one too.
Yeah. Episodes 6 and 7 are definitely a set.
Yeah.
There's been a few episodes like that over the course of the series, but I really feel like these two, like the episodes where, Morgoth is trying to turn, some of the Maiar onto his side back from season 1. Those three episodes, 9, 10, and 11, I think they are really kind of go together very, very well. And I think these two are kind of like that.
Yeah. 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 So episode 7, right? So your synopsis is Thingol, learning of the ship burning, confronts Angrod and Finrod, who tell him the truth of the kinslaying. Caranthir establishes a trading relationship with the dwarves. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we start with first of all, I know I'm going to forget to talk about the frame. Episode 6 was the frame in which the moon letters come out, and it ends with Bilbo's discomfort.
Yes,
right.
Yes, with Gandalf lying.
Gandalf lying. Yes,
yeah. But there's a number of things that happen in The Hobbit which kind of suggest that Gandalf is not being entirely honest with him. I don't buy for a second that Gandalf can't read the runes on the swords and figure out whose swords they have. Like, it's pretty obvious that he wanted to give Elrond the chance to be like, okay, so these are mine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without having to explain that to Thorin up front.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, even the one, was it Balin who kind of called him on that as far as lying about Bilbo being a burglar, right?
Yes. I mean, yes.
You know, Gandalf's improvisation about, you know, his trying to pawn off Bilbo as burglar initially. That was, you know, yeah, that, I mean, that was kind of, that was kind of funny. And of course, especially in the context of, your recollection of the Honest Burglar title, and then, yes. Moving forward to Bilbo's surfeit of honesty in this episode, and then Gandalf's rebuke for him being too honest a burglar after all. I thought that worked that worked really well.
So basically, just to kind of, in case anybody either doesn't remember
please do give the synopsis there.
So basically, in episode 6, Gandalf takes Bilbo up to this observatory tower to go over this really ancient document that's super secure. It's got moon letters on it that'll only appear on Durin's day.
Yes.
Which we discussed over this past week that you actually can't have a lunar eclipse on Durin's day because that's not how it works. We had originally talked about having a partial solar eclipse, but partial one to differentiate from the other. Anyway, it's
fixed now, so it is a solar.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right.
More importantly, though, they find out that the reason that the original conflict between the elves of Mirkwood and the dwarves of Erebor came about was because Orifer had hired them to build these gates for his underground, you know, lair city place. And the gates had spells on them that were in Quenya. Now, of course, Orifer was still enforcing the ban, right? So he was like, no, I'm not having Quenya words on my gates. That's not a thing that's going to happen. And he didn't feel like it was fair that he should pay the entire price for only part of the work. Now, of course, the dwarves took umbrage at this because you agreed to pay this price. It's not our fault that you don't want all of the work done. This is like, it's a package deal. Like, this is the job.
Right.
And that's kind of laid out on this document. And Bilbo's like, well, we're going to have to tell Dane about this, obviously. And Gandalf's like, well, do we?
Right.
Because it's not necessary to reveal this information. We could just tell them the things he needs to know without telling him about this part, because there's some really unpleasant things that are going to follow.
Right.
So in this episode, Bilbo and Balin are kind of in their cups, and Balin's going on and on and on about how trustworthy Bilbo is and how, you know.
heaping coals of fire on Bilbo's head during the whole conversation.
And, you know, he's got the transcription of this document burning a hole in his pocket.
Yeah.
So finally he gives Balin the transcription of the document, and Balin immediately sobers up and is like, I need to get this to Dane right away.
Right.
And of course, Dane uses that information, confronts Thingol, Not Thingol. Wow, you know who I meant.
Yeah, semi-Thingol. Exactly.
Thingol in Thranduil. In spirit.
Thingol light, Thranduil. Yes.
Yes. So Thranduil gets confronted with this, and Thranduil's response is to basically take Dane, restrain him to prevent the rather large force of armed dwarves from storming the whatever place they are, the hall that they're that they're staying in, and they kind of like take over the town hall, leaving Bard out in the cold somehow, I guess.
Yeah, I felt so bad for Bard during
this. We kind of yada yada that.
Gandalf emphasizes that. Like, here's Bard minding his own business, trying to help everybody.
And I love that Gandalf wakes Bilbo up in the middle of the night for this conversation.
Yes.
That's fantastic. I don't think that we had anything. I think that was all Rhiannon. Rhiannon's doing it. And I really like it.
Yeah. No, we talked about him going in and waking him up, and we were like, if Bilbo was a Took, he would call him Fool of a Took. But Bilbo isn't a Took, so what is he going to call him instead?
I remember this conversation now.
Blabbering Baggins!
Yes, Blabbering Baggins, yes. Blabbering Baggins. So in the end, Bilbo has to kind of like talk Balin out of rescuing Dane, and gets the dwarves to stand down, which causes Thranduil, who's not Thingol, to relax just enough for Gandalf to extricate Dane from their clutches, and Dane goes back into the mountain.
Yeah. So I loved the so first of all, I mean, one of the things that's super cool about this plot line is that notice that it puts Gandalf in really uncomfortable company, right? In his decision to say, oh, let's just not tell Dane about this and keep this to ourselves, he's being like the Fëanorians, right? He's being, you know, he's recapitulating in parallel the decision that the Noldor made to hide the stuff from Thingol in the first place. And then in his confrontation with Bilbo, he's like, I mean, he doesn't call him descendant of rats, but he's like Thorin at the gate, right?
Yes, yes.
So, you know, so both of those moments, that's kind of uncomfortable, right? But
Bilbo did kind of meddle in the affairs of wizards.
He did. He did, absolutely. And yet, like, he's not wrong either, right? I mean, Bilbo isn't wrong. I really like that. I mean, because it's not, Gandalf is, because I feel like that's done without making, that is, Gandalf is put into these uncomfortable parallels, right. without making him look dumb and without right. making him, you know, seem a fool or to seem wicked or anything. And yet, and, right. we can and see.
Gandalf, we trust Gandalf. So, like, we know that he came, like, we know he was coming at this from a good place.
Right.
You know.
And yet. We, yeah.
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 Yeah, exactly. So, no, I thought that was great. You know, it was, and especially since there's, you know, I think there's a temptation. I mean, goodness, I think you can see this temptation in Tolkien really clearly, especially in the essay on the Astari that's in Unfinished Tales, to, like, make Gandalf into, like, the idol, you know. Yeah. Like, Gandalf is the one Astari who does nothing wrong ever, you know.
Right, yeah.
You know, Tolkien got kind of, like, hero worship of Gandalf, right. you know,
I mean,
afterwards.
Let's be fair. Gandalf is the guy who thought it was a great idea to send a hobbit in to a dragon's lair, like,
which in his defense it kind of was in the end.
Yes,
right.
But Gandalf yeah. also didn't know he was going to come across the One Ring.
Exactly.
Either.
Exactly.
So
yeah. No, I mean, I love it, but that's why I thought that it was interesting and kind of bold, right? Because I think yeah. that following Tolkien, you know, people who love Tolkien, people who love the Lord of the Rings, tend to have that mm-hmm. kind of hero worship for Gandalf, you know. So seeing Gandalf, you know, being confronted with the uncomfortable fact that Gandalf yeah. is following in, you know, the Feanorians and crazy yeah. Thorin's footsteps here to some extent is good. That's healthy. I like it a lot.
I mean, the thing is, like, at this point, I think I've read The Lord of the Rings too many times to not see when Gandalf is not being honest with
right,
people.
Right.
Like
yeah.
he does it all the time. And, like, it's clearly okay for him to be doing this. Like, he's clearly doing a good thing, but, like, okay, there's, like, why on earth, like, Denethor, were he not clearly verging on being a crazy person, Denethor deserved to know that Aragorn was coming to take the throne.
Absolutely, just going to bring that up. I mean, what he does with Bilbo at the end of episode 6 in the frame here is very yeah. similar to a Pippin, probably best not mention Aragorn, you know?
Right. Yeah.
It's very similar. The motivation yeah. is very, the action is very similar. Let's hide this important thing. And the reason is very similar because, like, he's probably not going to take it well and it's going to complicate things. So let's just right. skim by that if we can. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
And it is information that person really is kind of entitled to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know? So anyway, that's the frame of this episode. And,
Well, you know, the other thing with drawing parallels between Gandalf and the Feanorians is that you can interpret it the other way and say the Feanorians are like Gandalf.
Yes.
So it's sort of not portraying them as the absolute bad guys. And so you yes. sort of see that, yes, they had some reasons for not bringing this up because they were interested in not creating more conflict.
Yes, exactly. It does. I agree that is a really good effect too, that it does kind of soften, especially in this episode where so much of the emphasis is on Thingol's perspective, right?
Right.
And Thingol's sense of betrayal, not just about the kinslaying, which is horrible enough, but his sense of betrayal by Angrod and Finrod, right?
Personally.
Yeah, exactly. So to Rhiannon, as you say, to have that slightly softened by that other perspective to say, you know, sometimes even, you know, wise and prudent wizards like Gandalf kind of make the same. It's not necessarily a horrible call.
Right. What's really interesting about this, I'm sorry to cut you off.
That's okay.
One of the interesting things about this is that nobody in this situation is really wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like, this conflict erupts. Like, Dane's not wrong for being upset about this.
Mm-hmm.
Thranduil's not wrong for being concerned for his personal safety.
Yes.
Gandalf's not wrong for keeping this information secret. And Bilbo's not wrong for revealing it. And
right.
Balin's not wrong for trying to rescue his king.
Right, right.
Like, nobody's really entirely in the wrong here, and yet these people almost come to blows over this.
Right, right.
Millennial old secret.
Right. Of all of those things, the weakest link in that whole chain, I think, is Dayan's reaction.
Yes. That well, it's was, over money.
Right. It's over money. I mean, to some extent, it's just kind of a like, oh, those dwarves, you know, and their yeah. like obsession with, you know, with holding grudges and things like that. But that one was definitely, I think, the weakest link of the lot.
Yes. Right.
That for him, and the one thing I would say, I guess, in its defense is that it was set up by, if we read, and of course we don't actually get the scene of Dan hearing it and thundering off, you right. know, we only meet that after the fact, but if we assume that Dan's response was basically along the lines of, I knew it, right? I was right to suspect, I mean, I knew yeah. that they were untrustworthy. Haven't I been saying this?
They've been untrustworthy for thousands of years.
Exactly, right? This only just shows that they've been, you know, we've been saying that we don't think they're reliable allies, and now we have proof that they've never been, you know, history bears us out in our suspicions of them.
And amusingly, yeah. Thranduil probably doesn't even really know about
doesn't
this.
Doesn't even know about it, right? I mean, and when it predates the King yeah. of the Elves, like, you know, it's an old grudge, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, cool. All right, well, having discussed the Framework Act, let's push ahead yeah. here into Act 1. Okay, so Act 1, we've got the Celeborn and Galadriel plot. Right. Angrod and Finrod arriving, and the beginning of the reveal to Thingol, and then of course we have the beginning of the trade relationship plot with Curufin and Amras arriving,
right,
to join right. Carinthir and Telkar still.
Yeah, so this is a little slower start than some of the other episodes because it's mostly character building with Celeborn and Galadriel yeah. and just kind of exploring how they're becoming more comfortable with each other. And
this was the boat how, scene, wasn't it?
Yes.
This is the boat scene.
Yeah, so they discuss the two trees. They discuss Sindarin and Quenya's languages.
Yeah.
They talk about the what if we had met in Valinor and then taken a ship to Middle-earth by ourselves.
oh, boy. Possibility. That's hilarious. Yeah.
Right. And then the boat where...
I love that, by the way, again, like talk about your deeply concealed Easter eggs, right? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Man.
Right.
Yeah.
But the idea there is that Celeborn's being very protective of Galadriel.
Yeah.
As far as the, oh, so this is a boat, and right. I know you've got some trauma associated with boats. Like, is it
are
okay?
Are we ready for boats yet?
Yeah. Are we ready for boats yet, essentially? And she's like, yeah, I mean, it's a boat. I'm okay. But, you know, we see him being careful of her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, well, and of course, that's important.
You know, one of the things that I love about that is... You know, whenever we're dealing with characters like Galadriel, right, I always have an eye towards, like, the long game that we're playing with
yeah.
Lord of the Rings scenes down the road, right? So thinking about Galadriel and Celeborn on their little riverboat, you know,
yes.
Later on is
mm-hmm. yeah.
cool. Setting that up, you know, years and years in advance like that is so that, again... To do another one of those things, which again to me is like the coolest payoff of the entire film project, right? When you can take a scene, a familiar scene from The Lord of the Rings, and invest it with an entirely new layer of meaning based on, you know, these other things that we have.
Yeah.
So yeah, seeing Galadriel and Celeborn riding a boat down the river together, as we first saw them do there in Doriath, and especially with its associations of her grief and their confidence and, you know, on all those yeah. things. Oh man. Like yeah. to think yeah. about the way that those things can get kind of recapitulated, associated with the gifting moment. It's so cool. So cool.
Mm. Hey, can you guys remind me, is this the first episode where we have Mablung and Thingol playing their board game together?
I think it's so. The second time.
It's the second time. I don't remember the first one.
Yeah, but it just became like a running thing. Like when we needed to have Thingol and Mablung in the same room together, we said, well, I guess they could just be playing their game again, which, you know, they kind of got this, you know, Kirk Spock chess game
right.
thing going on, which,
yeah.
which was fun.
That's fun. I liked it.
And basically, and what's interesting is that the scene in which they're playing that game is right, is right at the scene where all the pieces in this episode are now in play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like the games of, is actually about to start
right
in that scene.
Right. The game's afoot.
The game is absolutely afoot. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. No, I like that motif. Okay. So there's so much to talk about in the larger Thingol plot here.
Yeah.
Let's separate out the Caranthir plot so mm-hmm. that we don't have to keep jumping back around to that. So act by act with the Caranthir plot, right? So first we have Curufin and Amras arriving, right? So we have more players on the field. And so Caranthir has established in the previous episode a like congenial interaction.
A rapport, yeah.
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 But they haven't yet moved further to like trade agreements, right?
Yeah. By the way, this is precisely what we do during the script discussions. We separate out the plot lines to set them up to figure out where they're going to be and when, so that we're able to then match everything up in the tension curve of the episode.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So
then
the timelines kind of make sense.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, it also helps us have the timelines because it makes sense because the amount of time it would take Angrod to travel, like go get Finrod and then travel to Doriath would be about the time it takes and the dwarves that he's found to get back to their castle Teleborn.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. Good. Okay. So in the second act, then Caranthir is trying to unsuccessfully tries to demand that the dwarves treat him as a middleman. And so if I'm remembering, his demand is basically don't trade with the Sindar anymore, just trade with me, essentially.
Right. Exactly. He's basically trying to completely corner the market on dwarf goods. Yeah. And the dwarves are like, why would we do this?
Right. What's in this for us? Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Why should we trade with just you when we could trade with you and them? Yeah.
Right.
Okay. And then in act three, Amras is like, Curufin, he needs help. Like, this is not going well. Was it in act two when Curufin actually kind of defends Caranthir and he's like, no, he's like kind of trying to do the dwarf thing, right? He's trying to speak their language here.
Right. So, yeah. So Curufin,
I think that was act two.
Was it act two? Okay. Yeah.
Is able to read in the situation that Caranthir is uniquely placed to be the guy who talks to the dwarves.
Right.
Right. Curufin is such a shady dealer that the dwarves, like, just like Norn immediately picked up on Galadriel's ambition.
Yes.
The dwarves might immediately be able to see in Curufin that this is a guy, like, you know that guy that when you're playing Monopoly with them, you know not to make any deals with that person? Like, right. Regardless of how beneficial to you they may seem, obviously he's got an advantage built into this deal. So I'm just not going to make any deals with him whatsoever. That's Curufin. And he might realize that the dwarves are going to kind of pick up on that.
Yeah.
So Caranthir, as the idiot, right, is a uniquely useful tool in this regard.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked that. I mean, I liked the fact that we can see Curufin not exactly manipulating Caranthir here, because Caranthir is doing it on its own steam,
right,
you know. But basically sort of being back and like, no, this is all working out in a sense appropriately.
Right? Everything, you know, is proceeding as I have.
Exactly. Right. Yes. Yeah. I knew that Caranthir would react this way and that would be advantageous. And seeing his sort of criminal mastermind at work there was good. So basically the culmination of this is just Curufin telling Caranthir, okay, dude, new plan, toll, not Monopoly, toll, right?
Like,
right, you know, and then that, you know, becomes acceptable. Using this as the way to introduce Angrist seemed to be a really good way to kill two birds with one stone, right? Both established the wealth of Carinth, the resources of Carinthir because of his enrichment by the trade with the dwarves. And also showing how Angrist gets into Kurufin's possession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the one item that Tel'Kar made that shows up in this season. Yes. So we obviously wanted to highlight it and give it a meaningful role in the plot as well. And Amy's Revenge, Mike had come up with some ideas on how we could use the admiration for the Dwarvish craftsmanship on the part of the Noldor to have mutual respect, and so that Angrist going to Curufin should be part of that storyline.
Right.
We didn't end up doing it the exact way that he had suggested, but we wanted to make sure it had that same meaning.
Right.
Also, we put a little bit of a curse on it, which will pay off, but... yeah, so...
Which is a totally dwarvish thing to do, so yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
But Carinthir, Tel'Kar is clearly trying to send Carinthir a message, but Carinthir just kind of like laughs it off and passes the curse on to Curufin.
Right.
Instead.
Cheerfully. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, obliviously, yes. Primarily, I guess, but yes. Yes.
But like, kind of like, well, I don't want this thing. Here you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Okay. So let's go back to the primary plot then. So we've got the arrival of Angrod and Finrod. We don't get much with Angrod and Finrod in Act 1, right?
They get there and Finrod comments on the Girdle of Melian, and they kind of update the audience on the, by the way, Angrod's wife got kidnapped,
yeah.
And he's upset about this.
And he's upset about
and this. Is actually Angrod.
He passed through the Girdle of Melian.
Yes.
Yeah. No, that was
this one isn't Sauron in disguise. This is the real one.
Right. Right. Yeah. 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 There's no sneaking.
So yeah, it's to kind of reorient the audience to Angrod not being a prisoner and not being Sauron, but in fact being Angrod,
who is trying to recruit help for the rescue of his wife.
Yeah, and can I say, adding that weight to this scene, you know, that the scene when Thingol is going to send Angrod and Finrod packing, being the moment when Angrod has come to beg for help to rescue his imprisoned wife, makes that much more powerful. It puts a little more pressure on it, right? Because, I mean, there's already a huge risk that Thingol's going to look like a jerk in this moment.
Right.
And that kind of ratchets up the pressure, likelihood of him looking like a jerk. But nevertheless, it certainly does add more. This is not just a routine piece of diplomacy that goes bad, right? This is more personal, and therefore, now of course, like the kinslaying is also personal. So, that's all understandable. But anyway, okay, so. And the one thing I was uncertain about, and again, correct me if I'm misremembering here, because I'm now coming up to the scenes I've only read once, or the episodes I've only read once, so I might remember them imperfectly. Círdan and Thingol's first conversation there in Act 1, they don't really get to... Círdan tells him what he knows, right? Burning of the ships, right? And then they kind of end their scene by saying, like, let's kind of talk about this and figure out what this must mean, right?
Yes. They're talking about they have terrible suspicions,
yes.
But they want to discuss it and like make sure everybody's thinking the same thing.
Right.
They haven't really arrived at kinslaying yet, but they're all thinking, oh my gosh, what if this actually was a kinslaying?
Right. So
right.
That
so
the reveal of the so the kind of Thingol figuring out, Círdan and Thingol both figuring out that the kinslaying must have happened, happens off stage, essentially.
Exactly.
So yes, that we don't get the reveal until Thingol delivers his line.
Right. Or it's not explicit that they knew, that they completely figured it out.
Yeah.
Based on that, it's not entirely clear until Thingol goes and confronts Angrod and Finrod. And now he knows.
Right.
And Thingol actually may not have figured it out at that point. He could be sort of testing Engrod and Finrod and seeing, well, if I say kinslaying, are they going to say...
Kinslaying? What? Yeah.
Wait, no, we didn't do a kinslaying. We did it instead. Or they're going to say, yeah, actually, we did a kinslaying and we're really sorry.
Right.
Yeah. No. So the idea is that Kierden is being very cautious. He doesn't want to make a false accusation.
Right.
He's
right.
not sure how accurate his information is. He knows something bad happened. He's got some hard evidence and some suspicions, but he's afraid to go to Thingol and be like, hey, the Noldor are all guilty of killing the Teleri without proof. Like, he can't quite get himself to say that. Thingol can turn around and be like, hey, I got no problem saying that.
Yeah.
Right. And confronts Angrod and Finrod with that and see what comes out.
Right.
Like, if he says, you come to me red-handed, what do you have to say for yourself?
Yeah.
He assumes the truth will come out. So Thingol is taking a very different approach, a little bit more of the angry accusation approach than the cautious, I don't want to say too much, but there's something really bad here that Kierden's doing.
And there's something about, so like when Thingol gets word of Maedhros's words calling him, you know, the dark elf, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now Thingol obviously knows he's not a dark elf.
Right.
But in his mind, those words came from the Noldor as a whole.
Right. Right.
It wasn't just this one guy who said that or this particular group of guys. The Noldor said it.
Yes. Yes.
And so regardless of how cordial his relationship with the children of Finarfin has been up until this point, that's still in the back of his mind.
Right.
You know, and that's part of why he's so willing to antagonize them here on some kind of tenuous connections that are being made here.
Yeah. I've mentioned before that anytime you guys come to, you know, lines of dialogue straight from the book, it's always awesome. Like, it's always awesome when that happens, when all of a sudden, like, lines from the book just get integrated into the dialogue. This was the coolest payoff of book dialogue yet. Like, this was totally the best payoff.
I agree.
Because, of course, all of those lines are so good from the book. You know what I mean? Like, it's such a great exchange. And it's such a long exchange, longer than any similar kind of quotation that you guys have done yet. In season four. But the way that that whole exchange works and fits, right? I mean, the best possible payoff, right, is to get the lines straight from the book, have them work perfectly well, not only have them match up, like without visible seams between them and the rest of the dialogue and the rest of the, you know, the episode that we see, but to have the earlier stuff really feel like it gives this extra weight, right? Just exactly, Nick, as you're saying, when Thingol stands up and delivers his, you know, I am surprised at you, son of Arwen line, it's perfect. Like, we can see, like, knowing we've had episodes of setup, which feels like it culminates in that line, right?
Yeah.
I thought that the payoff was really spectacular in that scene. I just loved how that came across.
And we know, the audience knows, that Angrod and Finrod are walking into a hornet's nest.
Yes.
Like, because we know that Kierden brought the news, and we already know that Galadriel's been, for lack of a better term, arrested.
Yes.
So we already know that Angrod and Finrod are walking into this blind trap. And they have no idea what's about to go down.
Yeah. Oh, quick note on that. I didn't feel strongly about this, but the arrest of Galadriel felt a little heavy-handed. I wasn't sure. I was kind of plus minus about the arrest of Galadriel. Because clearly Thingol's going to have a strong reaction, and I like the effect on Luthien. I mean, I like the scene when Luthien comes and is like, "Dad, the heck, right?" I like that. And of course, I love the irony of like that they're in the middle of Galadriel teaching Luthien a Quenya song, right? And then it's like awkward. Yeah. But I did that. That was all cool. But I guess again, the question that I had is like, okay, is that would Thingol do that, and why would he do that? Like, why would he like restrain her? You know, is there a reason he would restrain? Because, I mean, yeah, he probably, I mean, I can understand how he would feel upset at her, right? But it's not like she needs to be restrained or kept under control, exactly. It's
She is about to accuse her brothers of murder. Go.
Okay, well, maybe we could somehow parallel this to what we were talking about planning to change in episode 6, where we have Thurin Gwethil taking her own death, or like thinking that the other Noldor or someone has gone after her. If we made that into a she definitely ran away, and that's what Círdan thinks happened, is that she ran away with the help of the other Noldor, then he could tell that to Thingol, and Thingol could be like, let me make sure this doesn't happen to the Noldor that are currently like, in my kingdom.
We have reason but to suspect a big Noldor conspiracy. Yeah.
That kind of gives the lie to like, this idea that she, like, why would the Noldor help her at this point? Help Thorin Gwethil at this point.
Yeah, because it does go against her expressed concerns for her safety in the company of the Noldor. Well, like the faking her own death thing fits better with what's already been said in that episode. Though I agree, I mean, I do agree with you, Rhiannon, that if we did it the other way, it would set this up a little bit better. But I guess it seems to me...
Maybe if the guards weren't so clueless, like, would that maybe help if they had, like, more... If they weren't like, oh, I don't know, your dad said, like, because that's kind of the way they come across. Right. It maybe if they had more to say.
So, for instance, instead of having Galadriel be arrested, would it be better if she were being summoned and then being asked to wait to speak to the king later?
Yes.
So, like,
and she could be watched. I mean, there can be armed guards there watching her the whole
time. Right. So effectively, nothing would change about what happens. Guards show up and be like, Galadriel, the king wants to talk to you. And then she's led away.
They take her to the room and,
It's, so, like, I think... everything would play out. We'd have a reason for it now that doesn't sound like, oh, no, I'm just told to arrest you.
Right. It was just like the act of essentially cuffing her and dragging her off that seemed to me a little unnecessary. Like, one half step too far for Thingol to take, right? For him to the one thing that would change is it would change Luthien's response,
her level of concern.
Maybe he summons her though. Maybe Thingol summons the, because I would think that one of his impulses would be like, oh yeah, hang on, like. One of the Noldor is here in my house, and oh, by the way, she's like now BFFs with my daughter. Maybe I need to pull my daughter aside and be like, we need to talk about this.
We could, but it's like they're going to be asking questions as to why they're not going in
together
to see him together.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing that could happen, so Luthien could be suspicious of like if armed people show up to escort Galadriel to wait to see Thingol. That's weird. Like, this isn't the Noldor. The Noldor are walking around armed all the time.
Right.
The Sindar have armed soldiers, but they're like, that's not everybody is like that. So, like, normally he would send like his major domo or whoever, kind of person, his seneschal or whatever, to go pick her up.
You mean Celeborn, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You would send Celeborn to cook. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, the very fact that he sends armed guards could be enough to arouse suspicion on both their parts.
Yeah.
Like, both of them could be sitting there like, all right, this is a little different. And Galadriel kind of knows the jig is up, and Luthien is suspicious enough to go and now talk to her father, and she can still tell her, I'm going to go speak to my father, because there's like a subtextual understanding between the two of them that it's weird.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that I think would work. That would feel, that would affect exactly. I mean, in fact, as you know, Maria, as you said, you'd barely have to change anything, to do that, but it softens it to make it feel less,
threatening.
Yeah. Well, less forceful, less, less, a little bit less over the top.
Ham-fisted.
Yeah. Yeah. More delicate in the transition.
Well, the other thing we need to remember that happens in this scene is that Galadriel, as she's being led away by the guards, she walks past Celeborn. And so she like looks accusingly at Celeborn, and Celeborn looks at her like, what is going on? So Galadriel thinks that Celeborn was the one who told him, that's why she's being arrested. And Celeborn is like, what the heck is going on with Galadriel?
Right.
Right. And that could still happen.
That can still happen. Exactly. Cause I mean, exactly as Nick is saying, just the fact that she is walking in the company of armed guards, I mean, Celeborn is going to still
be... And Celeborn doesn't know anything about it.
Know anything about it at all. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
All right.
So, yeah, exactly. Like, they don't have to have, like, you know, her arms pinioned behind her in order for that to look ominous, right? Yeah. And for her to look accusing. Can I make a confession? Here's my confession. In retrospect, I couldn't believe that I hadn't thought of this, but I had totally not thought of that angle. Like, as soon as you guys brought up the, like, and of course Galadriel assumes that it was Celeborn who told them. If I did think of that, I have already forgotten that I had thought of that. Cause that came to me as a surprise. I was like, yeah, man, of course she's going to think that. That's really cool. Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. Cause she didn't know that like a vampire was going to go and like, right, throwing up vague hints at Círdan for it to start arousing suspicion.
Occam's razor does kind of suggest that Celeborn spilled the beans.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, that was good.
And then and we also get the nice scene between the three siblings,
mm-hmm,
when they're in like the green room under guard. While Thingol is deciding their doom, essentially.
Right.
And when Luthien finds out that Celeborn knew also.
Right.
Which I think we came up with that on our own. I don't think that you guys.
No, I'm pretty sure I totally forgot about that whole angle there.
Yeah. And so when we get to the episode where Thingol finds out that Celeborn knew, well, his daughter also knew,
right,
and didn't tell him.
Right, right, right.
Or rather, she knew that Celeborn
she
knew.
She knew that he knew. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
By the way, is there a kind of like there must be this kind of chart in scholarly circles that depicts when individuals in a story or in a group discover certain pieces of information. There must be some kind of figure that people use to describe that, because that seems like the kind of thing that would exist, right?
Right, right. Yeah, it does.
Timeline.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not like something which shows the relationships between people and when exactly they find out a particular piece of information. And I'm not entirely certain how you even depict that outside of three dimensions, and I can't be the first person to ever think about this, because never the first person to think of anything.
Yeah, no, it does sound like a thing that would exist. I thought, but we skipped the Melian scene. So,
oh yeah, yeah.
I liked the Melian scene. Here's the thing that I was most pleased by with this episode. I thought you guys succeeded remarkably well in doing what I think is the absolute hardest thing about this entire scene. And that is making Thingol not sound like a jerk and an idiot when he delivers the ban. It would have been so easy for Thingol, mm-hmm, to come off sounding reactionary, petty, out of touch, or just like out of control, you know. But the conversation with Melian in advance really demonstrated that, like, when he delivers the ban, it successfully sounds like a reasoned response, right? Like this is, he's not letting this go. You know, he is taking this very seriously, but he is restraining himself from doing, like, there's like a whole hierarchy of much more extreme reactions that he could have had, that he was tempted to have, but that he didn't, he's restraining himself from. And so the ban ends up actually sounding like a relatively diplomatic compromise, essentially.
Right. Right.
And I thought that came off really well. I was initially during when I first got to the discussion between Thingol and Melian there, I was, and Thingol was like, maybe we should just off them all. You know, I was like, well, okay, that's a little, maybe, I don't know. But then again, the way that set up the ban, I mean, the effect of that scene, again, I think some of that stuff could be softened a little bit. But still the overall effect, you know, the overall effect of the payoff that had when he delivered the ban, I thought was really good.
One of the things that I really, and I have no recollection of exactly whose idea this was, but one of the things I really like about that scene, as I read like the synopsis of it, is that Melian goes into Thingol's throne room, and instead of sitting by his side, which is her proper place, mm-hmm. she stands before his throne.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably below him, because I assume that his throne has got to be like raised up at least a little bit so that people can see him if the room is crowded.
Though he is,
he's the tallest elf ever. So
that's true. That's true. But she's also a Maya. So, like,
but he's sitting down, you know. So
right, yeah. But the idea of her like humbly looking up to him, rather than really taking her rightful place, I thought was really, really interesting about that, about the way that plays out.
Yeah. And I loved the little foreshadowing of the like Galadriel and Celeborn action in the Fellowship of the Ring, right when Melian is mm-hmm. like, ah, you are king and your word is law, and like you are clearly the big deal around here, right? Not me at all. it felt very Fellowship of the Ring there, but that was cool.
Everybody knows who's in charge.
Everybody knows who's in charge here. Yeah,
it's me, right?
Yeah, clearly.
Of course. Clearly. Of course. Of course.
Yeah. But yes, no, I did like that as well. So I guess there are some things, I don't think that their conversation needs major change. Again, I think I would, mm-hmm. I'd probably tone it down so that, it sounds a little bit less extreme.
He's mad, and he's kind of like, he's kind of mouthing off a little bit,
and privately. And I wanted it to sound like scarily extreme.
Yes.
But like, that conversation where he's like, and we could just cut off all their heads.
Right,
then he's supposed to sound like ridiculous.
Well, it's also not
taking it too far. And so like the audience needs to be like, well, Thingol is the one in power, so like if he really wanted to do this, he could do this, so we should be afraid of him. But also, like, this guy's really crazy. I hope that Melian can talk him down from this.
Right. The revision that I would suggest, because I agree, I really liked that effect, because again, that's exactly what made the ban seem so reasonable when he delivers that. I mean, I found myself like almost sighing in relief when Thingol delivers the actual ban, right? But the thing that I would suggest there, for him to sound less like crazy slasher guy and more like completely merciless judge, right? You know, so for him to say something like, you know, death they have earned by their deeds, and death I might give them, you know, that kind of tone, or like, you know, death I should give them, you know, for their betrayal. And,
better than off with their heads.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Better than like, I'm just going to pick out my sword and go cut off their heads right now. You know, like that was, I was like, whoa, dude. Okay.
And also he actually can't cut off all their heads, like all being the Noldor, because that's a seriously empty threat. Cause there's no way he's pulling that off. Yeah. You know, like there's no way that Thingol is going to invade the north of Beleriand and assault these castles that the Nolor have set up.
When he's outnumbered and out, you know, and outgunned and everything else.
Yeah, there's no way that's going to happen. Yeah. So, like, confining the threat and making it a more ominous... Making it a more ominous threat rather than a... Rather, you know, like, that I think might be a little bit more effective and might scare the audience a little bit more.
Right. Right.
Than him being...
Just out of control.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry. Rhiannon, you were gonna add?
What I was trying to convey with this scene was that he knows about the doom of Mandos. Mm-hmm. So he sort of interprets that as, well, Mandos said their doom. He didn't really enact it. So it's up to me as King of Beleriand to actually go through and enforce this doom. Since the Valar haven't come over, it falls to me. And then that's why Melian has that line at the end where she's like, there's only one Valar in Beleriand. That's the one whose will you'll be doing if you kill these people.
That was a great line. I loved that. Yeah. Maybe the inclusion of a phrase like to bring their doom down upon them. Like, you know, their doom has been spoken. You know, perhaps I should bring their doom down. Something like that. But
a little less explicit, maybe.
Yeah.
It's still ominous and still threatening. And that's that. Right. Yeah. So just to change the tone slightly.
Threatening is definitely the vibe that we should be getting from that. Like, we should definitely feel like the children of Finarfin are in danger. Just, you know, like in the last episode, we should feel a little bit worried for Theron Gwethil's safety, which is going to feel kind of weird, especially when you find out what Sauron's doing. But you should definitely be concerned for the safety of the children of Finarfin in this episode.
Yeah.
Much more so than Theron Gwethil.
Yes, definitely. So I think it just like I would recommend his tone to be more, and like, to me, I would be most concerned about their safety if it looked like the line Thingol was going to take was absolutely merciless judge. Right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I will, like, you know, they have come to my court and I will visit justice upon them. Again, he's not going to say exactly that, but because, again, we can feel pretty confident, I think, that he's not just going to fetch a sword and start hacking, right? Somebody's likely to intercede before that happens. But it's totally plausible, and he's well within his rights to say, like, you know, this is the law, but you know, you're guilty. I am the king, and I am going to pronounce your doom. Like, he can totally.
And you three are at least are in my power.
Right, exactly. I can't reach them, but I can reach you. I mean, so.
And that, there's a little of that going on as well.
To fear. Like, that's a super plausible fear under the circumstances. Yeah. And again, of course, this works as a, if we think forward and not too far in the future, of course, with Beren's appearance before him in the hall, his response, he's angry, but he responds not with intemperance, but with deviousness, right? With cold, merciless deviousness towards Beren. So again, he's not, even when he's angry, he's not of the, like, I'm just going to whip out my sword and start slashing at folks kind of anger, right? His is like,
and that's really not what I was trying to convey. I was trying to convey him as, like, he will be their judge, their jury, and their executioner.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So I think it's just kind of a slight tonal shift that I'm thinking of there to kind of emphasize the implacability of his wrath rather than the fire of his wrath. If you see the difference that I mean there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Again, it would just be a subtle shift of some of his lines, but,
right.
But yeah, that's good. Okay. Well, we're pretty well out of time already. We certainly shouldn't start another episode. But although we're taking longer here, this has been great. I feel really happy with the discussion we've had of episode 6 and 7 today.
Yeah. There is one thing I wanted to bring out about the scene, where Luthien kind of confronts Galadriel, and then Celeborn, you know, rushes in, and Luthien now confronts him. When he kind of tells us what we've been talking about ever since the kinslaying, when he tells the audience that the people who have committed murder suffer just as the people who they murdered suffer, but they're going to come back, you know, like they're going to be healed. The people who committed the murder, they have to live with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even if they do get healed of their hurts in Mandos, they have to carry that around as long as Arda exists.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's going to be a reiteration of what he says to Galadriel in episode 5 with the Mare of Adathod.
Yeah.
Where he's like, so you can't heal the fact that they've been killed, but you can heal your own guilt by like letting go of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, this is what I wanted to end with here, fitting that it come at the end of the episode. Not going to lie, I totally teared up in that scene. Absolutely teared up in those, like with the reveal to Galadriel that Celeborn like had kept her confidence and his speech there. I was totally like standing in line at the grocery store, like sniffling, you know, and like trying to like, you know, people were like sidling away from me and stuff. But it was like, it was seriously, I found that was the most moving scene. Episode 6, the reveal with Angrod was really powerful. But that was wonderful. That whole scene was really powerful.
Yeah. I really have been enjoying as we find ways to bring in kind of, because we've had a lot of really deep discussions about a lot of this stuff over the past couple of years now. Yeah. And to find ways to bring that directly into the show it's really been very satisfying.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was really good. I mean, it's because people do need to remember the Elvish context of this, right? I mean, in one way of looking at it, the fact is murder is kind of a less of a big deal for the elves than it is for men. I mean, that's just kind of, it's not that the act of murdering isn't bad, but like for the victims, like it's not as bad for the victims as it is for men. It's important.
And it's also like, it's not just about the elves though. It's us too, because like, when the way that Gandalf talks about Gollum, for example, Gollum's mortal.
Yeah.
You know, but we pity Gollum because he's suffering.
Right.
Even though he's clearly a villain.
And even though he's done horrible things. Yeah. And is doing horrible things again.
Yeah. But we really feel the loss that, you know, of someone who just can't get out of their own way.
Yeah.
You know, we all know people like that. We all have been people like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I really think that the themes of this season, you know, which were so powerfully coming out in these final scenes of this episode. I mean, this is deep stuff. I mean, this is really powerful stuff, I think. And
not bad for a Beleriand and its realms, huh?
Not bad for, who knew Beleriand and its realms would have such a powerful emotional impact, right? absolutely. Absolutely. Very good. Well, with that, I think we're going to skip ahead a little bit because, we're not going to have time for episodes 8 and we got a bunch of 9 there. But so in our next session is just going to be next week because we're getting back on our regular schedule from before. So our 28th session will be next week. We'll continue the scripts. Hope to get through 8 and 9, maybe 10 if we're feeling frisky. So Rhiannon and Sio, you'll get extra time to continue through the. You're still working on 13, is it?
Yes, I just finished, like, right before we started this session, I just finished Act 1 for Episode 13, so I'm getting through that. I had some trouble this week. I had a debate and public speaking tournament this week, and so I wasn't spending a lot of time on that because I did better in the tournament than I expected to, so I thought I'd be writing during the final round of that tournament, but I was competing during the final round.
Excellent.
So I had that. My laptop died. and I had to go get a new one. So like I tried to keep writing script, but I was writing script by hand while I didn't have a laptop. So I had to type it all up. I've had a bunch of stuff happening this week. I'm hoping that I'll have more time to get it done. And my Thanksgiving break from school is coming up. So hopefully I'll be able to finish up episode 13 while I'm on Thanksgiving break.
That is really
and on
dedication.
Top of that, she's had this really annoying guy coming along behind her, looking through her work in like excruciating detail and giving her like pages of notes over it. Yes. So I'm sure that can't have made it any easier.
No, please keep doing it. I absolutely love that. But like, if you don't give me feedback, then I'm always like questioning myself, and I'm like, did I make a good decision on this? Should I go back and change this? And sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't. But like, when I get that concrete feedback, and I know what other people think of that, that is the very best thing for writing.
Well, at least you get a little window into what's going on in my head whenever I'm writing anything. It's just like that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, thank you guys for all the work that you've been doing. These are really wonderful. Again, I can't recommend strongly enough for folks to go in and take a look at these scripts. This is some really excellent stuff, which I would like to spotlight much more. As we move forward. But anyway, so we will sign off for tonight. Look forward to joining everybody again on November 14th. And thanks very much, everybody. So I will say, as always, thanks for listening. Godspeed.